Do you have or are you thinking about getting an Apple Watch, Whoop, Fitbit, or Aura? How well can you trust these gadgets? The American College of Sports Medicine has named wearable technology as its top fitness trend for 2023. The real question is, how can you use the information to improve your health, longevity, and performance? Hello, and welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast, a space for trustworthy, science-based information from the world's leading experts on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer, and I am thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Ravi Komaturetti. Dr. Komaturetti is CEO and founder of Daytona Health, a digital health startup that combines the power of algorithms, human experts, and behavior change science to help you make and implement better health decisions. Ravi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Berquist.
Yeah, so excited to talk to you because just getting a little survey of our listeners, people have so many questions. And there's so many really interesting places around this. And I myself have had changing views about wearables. You know, I think at first I viewed them as interesting, probably more just as feedback. And now that I'm working on optimizing certain things like my sleep, I find the feedback even more helpful.
Yeah.
Before we jump in, let me ask you to give a little bit more of a bio about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to share this. And I'm excited that there's so much interest because that means that people are really interested in their health, which is always a good thing and something we struggle with trying to impart to our patients. So internal medicine board certified physician from the Midwest, originally trained out the East Coast and in the West Coast, ended up in San Diego where I, outside of clinical practice, ended up doing a digital health and wireless medicine fellowship at Scripps Research under Eric Topol. Ended up co-founding two companies in the digital health space, one kind of big data, trying to transfer the brain of a doctor into a computer, which was a large project, as you can imagine. And then the other was using virtual motion tracking technology to help do virtual physical therapy in the home using actually a video game camera. So it was one of the first instances of using consumer health technology to help with patient care and medical diagnoses.
That sounds sci-fi.
Yeah, it's really cool. It was one of those things where sometimes we in healthcare have the best stuff in terms of technology, but then when you look around, you can see other industries are inventing these tools that are so advanced and amazing. And you just think, we don't have to start from scratch, do we? We can, if we could just adapt, borrow, steal, copy, and beg in some cases to use some of these in healthcare, maybe we can speed up the process of innovation and get things that are helpful to patients faster. And that's what we did. It was the Microsoft Xbox Kinect camera, which is used by kids to play video games by making gestures. And I thought, wait a minute, why can't we use this to track physical therapy in the home? And that idea started on a napkin, and with the help of many other people and organizations, helped translate that to getting into people's homes to help them after they got knee and hip surgery. So one of those things that for anyone out there who thinks the road is long, I will say it is long, but it is worth it and possible.
Amazing. And how did you go from that company to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there were several hats that I wore over the last 10 years, I would say 15 years. So in terms of research, serving these technologies, wearables, helping give input on the design, and then also creating our own stuff with the company I just talked about, Reflection Health. And when you look into where the efficacy is coming from, and I'll use Reflection as a great example of this, through the process of learning why people do their physical therapy exercises, what you realize is the technology plays a very strong role in it in terms of the motion tracking and the numbers and the data around what we're giving to providers and the patients was important to motivate them. But really, it's the behavior change that you're trying to induce, isn't it? It's this idea of, okay, now you have data about your flexibility, the number of exercises you're doing, and the number of sessions a week you're doing, which is great. And that's something that like the PTs want to know and the patients want to know as well. But the key where the efficacy was coming from was that the system in its entirety was giving patients confidence and guidance to move. It was almost a conduit for clinical reassurance that was on demand in a way that us doctors couldn't do and the physical therapists couldn't do. And so that data played a very important role, but was one piece of the puzzle. And so that system was serving as a way to change people's behaviors and motivate them to stick to more exercises, or to the exercise that was prescribed more frequently. And when you look at that, I was just thinking, that's the real key here, isn't it? I mean, it's changing behavior. And this is a psychology problem. And when I looked at this deeper, I realized that we've solved a lot of these problems. It's just that we have it in healthcare. But, you know, Amazon gets me to buy stuff I don't need all the time off the front page. And for some reason, I'm watching something called The Crown on Netflix for 4 hours when I don't need to be. It's like other people have figured out how to, I would say, persuade us. That's a nice way of saying it. In other words, manipulate us to engage in certain patterns of behaviors and learn certain habits to either buy things or consume. And I just think there's a real opportunity to use that science and also the more emerging science in healthcare of behavior change to use those same principles and really add this extra layer onto wearables and tools and just diagnostics to help people use this data and turn it into real action.
That's really the crux of it, right?
That's really the crux of it. That's really the crux of it. Now, I'm not declaring war on medications or surgical interventions or those things. I mean, those could be really important tools as well. When I look at the landscape of problems that we're dealing with, though, these are cardiometabolic. And if you look at, I think, 2015's Lancet Global Burden of Disease report had a great review on this. It was like 71% of all of these cardiometabolic diseases, the ones that we're worried about, that we see in primary care clinic, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, stroke, dyslipidemia, 70% of that's related to lifestyle. Lifestyle is choices. And making choices is easy in the short term, but consistently changing your behaviors to adopt a new lifestyle pattern, we know is difficult. All of us struggle with it. And I put myself in that category too. You know, there are some nights, even though I'm running a health coaching company, I'm sitting there staring at a Reese's peanut butter cup being like, what, should I eat this or not? So we all struggle with this cognitive burden of making better choices. And so we started the company to try to solve that problem. And that is the problem, I think. It's like, it's not entirely the problem. You could max somebody on lifestyle and they may still need medications like Lipitor or other things too. But I do feel like we've gotten into the habit in healthcare of kind of pushing on the metabolic gas of the brake at the same time, right? You can't have people eating McDonald's 3 times a week and then giving them blood pressure medication. It's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. So I feel like there's a multi-pronged approach and we're really good at one part of it. If we do an honest accounting, but I feel like we need to shore up the other part, which is the lifestyle change.
Yeah, and I think this is such an important topic because this is really internal medicine, which is what I practice. And
yeah,
getting people to, I mean, I think a lot of people know that they need to eat better. I think a lot of people know that they need to exercise. And I see a lot of people who come back 6 months later, they maybe did well for the first few weeks after the last visit, and then they slid backwards. And I think it's just part of our human struggle. So I do want to come back to how we can use digital technology. I mean, this is really the crux of how it can help us in the future. But before we jump that far ahead, I want to take a step back and have you give us a lay of the land. When we talk about wearables, there seem to be so many devices. Can you mention the top ones, just even the more popular ones? They don't have to necessarily be the top ones, but the most popular ones, the type of data they can capture, maybe a little bit about cost, just because I think some people listening may have heard of some, may be interested in others, but just to give us your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, I'm going to zoom out just a little bit just to give some perspective on this, because these terms, there's so many terms out there. So just to clear things up for people, you know, the way I look at it, I think of this field of digital health. So people who may have heard this term, what we're referring to is the use of technology in healthcare. But we've been using technology in healthcare for a long time. So the four things I look at when I'm thinking about what makes digital health different is really four things. And this is my take. And I've just seen two of those things are democratizing the sensors and devices to do diagnostics. So things that used to take rooms full of people in labs in a hospital, we can now make them smaller, better, cheaper, and available to connect to your smartphone through a wearable or through a portable lab or whatever. So like getting things out of the hospital into the hands of people because it's cheaper and faster to do so. Secondly, it's democratizing the expertise. So instead of having a doctor or a radiologist or some other expert have to weigh in, it's like, can we use AI, algorithms, machine learning, other tools to help us interpret things like labs, EKGs, the radiograph, the dermatology, the pathology report. And as we see with things like ChatGPT and other things coming out now, like we are close, right? We're really close to seeing AI kind of increasingly help democratize that expertise. You may not need that MD all the time for those reports. You may need them for those complicated cases, for example, which allows it to be cheaper and more available. The third and fourth are it really by doing those two, those democratizing the tools and the expertise, you really are empowering people. So I see digital health as empowering people to take a more of a proactive and ownership role in their healthcare and their health destiny, which is super important given how these diseases that we talked about and the cost, just the cost of these diseases later in life for all of us. And then the fourth thing is prevention. Getting access to this kind of data and expertise should let us be better about preventing these diseases for people who have them, should be helping them improve, not just manage them. And also, in some cases, even reverse these processes. And there's good examples of that in diabetes management, for example. So that's the digital health space. And when I look at that big umbrella, underneath that umbrella, I see wearables is one part of that. These technologies that use us. So these are like continuous portable sensors that people adorn either in clothing or on their skin or on their wrist that are constantly measuring information and connected to another portable computer, like a smartphone, can give you that information over time and through algorithms or analytics can give you additional insight. So they can do some math on those waveforms. So they can tell you your heart rate, but they can do some extra math and tell you things like heart rate variability, which we can, as we can talk about, are useful for different things. Then there are other digital health devices that I wouldn't say are necessarily wearables or in the intersection between wearables and things like labs. So people may have heard of continuous glucose monitoring, which is a patch on the skin that is like a finger prick, but it does it continuously and tells your serum glucose or an approximate of your serum glucose into your phone. So a very different and cool way of getting data about your metabolism that isn't just limited to diabetics. And we can talk about that if you want to and how that could really help people without diabetes better understand their metabolism and their response to food and any insulin resistance. And then there are other devices that aren't wearables, but are trackers that are also, they come in both consumer grade and medical grade. So things like smart scales, blood pressure cuffs, and then there are medical grade wearables that have very high fidelity, things like BioStrap, for example, which people may not have, I mean, it's not as common as the more consumer grade. And then like the Cardia, which like Cardia Mobile, for example, is a device that measures a portable EKG. Again, another great example of democratizing that huge machine in the ER into a smaller machine that fits in your wallet or pocket. In the wearable space, as I mentioned, like BioStrap is more of a, I would say medical grade, FDA cleared, very high fidelity, great for when you're doing clinical trials or you need that level of data quality that you would get in a hospital, which isn't necessary for most consumer cases. In the consumer world, there's very popular ones that we've all heard of. So I'll mention a couple and I'll talk about some of the costs. So the Apple Watch has really emerged as a very high quality sensor with a lot of precision. We can talk about its accuracy is something different, but it's very reliable. It's made by Apple. That company's not going anywhere. It's going to be infinitely upgradable. And because of its computing power, it ends up being a platform for great analytics on top of what it's measuring. Other devices are like Whoop, which is kind of a wristband type watch that uses your phone as a screen and it has measurements as well. Oura, O-U-R-A, is another great one that's emerged over the last 7 years or so to become highly portable and reliable. It looks like a wedding ring, like a wedding band, and it's worn over one of your fingers. And there's a couple others as well that take the watch form and other versions of this.
And Robbie, what do you capture with each one? Like I know Oura, you can get sleep data. Can you also talk about the type of data you get from each one?
That's right. So the majority of these wearables are all capturing aspects of the same thing using very similar sensors. So sensors like photoplethysmography. So you're using infrared light to try to capture respiratory rate and pulse oximetry. So your blood oxygenation levels. You're measuring some element of heart rate electrically. So heart rate, and you can do additional math on top of that to get metrics. With things like the Apple Watch, the way it's built, you can actually capture an aspect of an electrocardiogram, so one channel ECG. So you can measure or detect things like arrhythmias. One of the most common ones, of course, being atrial fibrillation is one that's been the focus of many of these wearables. And the others, very important ones, are activity. Activity meaning the wearables themselves have a motion sensor. And with the motion sensor, you can detect things like acceleration, movement, and in what direction. And that can be helpful because when you are doing different activities, there are different motion patterns. So when you're running versus walking versus on an elliptical or whatever, and these motion patterns can be interpreted to try to detect what exercise you're doing and then detect how many calories being burned. Now, the watches and these wearables sometimes don't work just by themselves. They work alongside with your phone. So when you combine some of this data, like running waveform on the activity monitor, combined with the GPS sensor in your phone, you get to do really cool things like track where you're running, how you're running, what kind of power output. So you can see that together, these end up being an important part of a very cool system, right? To help you figure out these different aspects of your health. The activity one's pretty obvious because exercise requires activity and motion. Maybe the ones that are not so obvious is you can also use some of these sensors to do things like sleep detection. Now, we can go into the accuracy around that, but it's a good approximation of total sleep time. And there's different, compared to an in-hospital sleep study, they're not used for diagnostics. So we would never diagnose somebody with a sleep disorder with a wearable, with a consumer-grade wearable. However, they can give people some insight into their sleep habits, patterns, and have them correlate that to how they feel. And that can be an important way to help you make better decisions about what time you go to sleep, what kind of activity you do, the different distractions that are distracting you from sleep or their sleep hygiene and habits. So sleep, exercise, breathing, and then skin temperature for some of these wearables as well. And then location and a couple other metrics, respiratory rate and blood oxygenation. These are all like the kind of the basic things these are measuring. There are, the other metrics that some of them may advertise are usually extrapolated from the sensor data. Heart rate variability, calories burned, right? So caloric expenditure, which is most of these use proprietary algorithms, but you can, it's probable that they're based on like something like the Harris-Benedict equation, a very, for people in the space, a very standard type of estimation of basal metabolic rate. But everyone has their own kind of proprietary algorithms to do this, and some of them have been validated and some of them not. But I've seen the last couple years some very interesting metrics. So even though the wearables themselves are measuring largely the same five or six things, everyone takes that data and says, like Whoop, for example, has a great metric, which they call recovery. And other wearables are now trying to copy this and also make it useful. And they're trying to tell you, hey, don't just worry about your heart rate or don't worry about your sleep. We'll kind of do some fancy math and give you a composite score that's trying to tell you how well did you recover from activity the day before or the couple of days before. And that's, in some cases, a more useful metric, right? Because that can guide on how hard you want to exercise going forward and things like that. So I'm seeing some very creative ways that companies are using these metrics to help guide decision-making on how people should exercise, sleep, and so on and so forth.
And that's fascinating, right? Because recovery is so heavily tied to resilience.
Yeah.
And it's really such a good indicator. If a person wants to measure multiple things, like their sleep, their heart rate variability, their amount of calories burned, is there one device that is good at multiple things with the algorithms that they use? Or would you recommend one device for one measure and a different device? Like, would people need to get multiple devices to get the type of information that they would want?
I'm glad you asked that because I get this question a lot. And I'll tell you my philosophy on this. These things are all from $900 to $150 or even cheaper. So let's say $100 to $900, the Apple Watch Ultra being the one that's $900. I think you should use the lowest number of devices possible to get the data you need to guide decision-making. Like in this case, you can easily go down the rabbit hole of thinking more is better. And it's like the analogy I use is an airplane cockpit. As a pilot, you need basically six instruments to fly. But in some cases, you got to master the behaviors that lead to piloting a plane well. And in a student pilot, more data, more sensors, more airspeed indicators, and more dials all around you is not going to help you fly that plane better. And in this case, I think it's very similar. Use the minimum amount. And to be honest with you, I have not taken to the Apple Watch for years. I just never got it, never got the utility until the latest one came out, the Apple Watch Ultra. And I'm a big fan. I've tested a lot of these devices. The majority of them are very good, very well made, and they work really well, and they work as advertised. You know, Oura, Whoop, Fitbit, these are all very reliable, affordable devices. But the Apple Watch Ultra, to me, really does fit that sweet spot. It's the Cinderella shoe, if you will, for wearables for me. It just gets everything I need on a screen big enough to where I can see it. It integrates with Apple health app really well, which is useful because I don't want to go through five different apps and I don't want to put on six different devices. You're going to lose them. You have to charge them. They all have different. It's like, ugh, right? It's just get the one thing I need to guide the things that I think are important in my life for cardiometabolic health: sleep, exercise, nutrition, mindset, meditation. And those things, it helps me do really well. So I would pick one. You won't go wrong with any of the ones I mentioned. I just happen to like the Apple Watch Ultra better because I like that the Apple Watch makes that data available to any app that someone wants to write for the watch that can use that data creatively. I think it really ends up being a platform that's infinitely upgradable, which I like. And the sensor quality is very high on it too.
And would you recommend people track multiple things at once or focus on, for example, tracking sleep, using feedback, improving sleep, going on to, for example, a fitness workout and recovery, and taking one measure at a time and working on it? Or do you think it's helpful to get multiple types of information?
Yeah, I think sleep and exercise are the big two that these devices help. And I think you have to treat them differently because the interventions are different for each one of them. So I always think about when it comes to just medicine, and like we use a lot of labs as doctors, we're used to using data in a way that maybe many people aren't used to using when it comes to data about their bodies. I mean, there's probably some people who work in sales and engineering, they use data in different ways. But for us, we're used to using that data. And the way I always used to teach, you know, when you're teaching interns, I'm sure you say the same thing, which is labs and these numbers should be doing either one of two things. They should either be changing your mindset or reframing your perspective on some aspect of your health, or they should be changing what you do about it. So if it's not going to change your perspective or change your behavior, then the lab that you're getting or the number you're getting is either entertaining or for entertainment purposes, or it's useless. And that's how I think about it. So I think when I look at sleep data, I think, is it changing if I have, let's say, a week of just poor sleep numbers and I feel like really bad that week, I think, okay, this is helpful to me because now I can see something's going on here. I need to look at what I'm doing this week and see, like, did I get into a bad habit of something? Was I staying up too late working on something that I should have been better about? Let's say there's a project that took me to work until midnight every day. Maybe the next time that happens, I should be better about protecting that sleep time. Or maybe I should schedule better. Maybe I should delegate more. Like, these are all interventions I should do to make it so that doesn't happen again, because I don't want to feel like that again. So it's changed my perspective. It's motivated me to take an action or at least examine my behaviors to see what I should have changed so I can avoid that week again. So, and those interventions for sleep are going to be different. Maybe I was taking the phone to bed too late and I was looking at screens really late in the night, which is not really good for your pineal gland. So sleep interventions can be sleep interventions, and sometimes they're different from exercise interventions, right? So when I look at exercise data and my recovery is really bad and I've been just pushing it too hard in the gym and not recovering, I'm like, oh, maybe I should back off the strength training, or I can back off on my heart rate zone. And so it does change what I do. And so I do look at those two big ones differently, the sleep and exercise. It does help me in terms of figuring out what I should do. Obviously, these things are related, right? So like, you're going to sleep better if you work out harder. These are related, but this is why the recovery metrics and activity metrics are helpful, because they try to combine it. So it's like, my overall recovery is low and I'm feeling bad. What do I do? And I can go look at, well, how's my sleep been? What are the inputs to this equation? How's my exercise been? And then obviously nutrition as well. And there are apps that we use to track nutrition, and it's helpful. It's like, how have I been eating? Am I eating too late? Have I been eating out? Have I been traveling? Is what's been stressing me out? Have I just had bad habits that week? So it really does help me figure out what to do. The other thing I will say is there are times when, and I think this is what sometimes confuses or makes it difficult for us doctors. I would say sometimes we discount the psychological aspect of this data for patients. And sometimes we say, well, I'm not going to change the dose of your medicine based on this number, or I'm not going to do some intervention I usually do. But for patients and for all of us, sometimes data can change our perspective. So it's like, even though I wore a CGM for 30 days about a month ago, just to test it out, and I was super skeptical. I was, there's no way. Like, I know eating a tub of ice cream is going to increase my blood glucose. Why do I need to have a sensor for that? But when I had it on, it really did change my behavior for eating. I was much more careful about it. So it's not even that I changed that much of what I usually eat, but it was more, I was more thoughtful about it. I was more intentional about what I ate. And that is a really good thing to cultivate for long-term lifestyle change: intentionality, better habits, engineering your environment. If those are the things we're looking for our patients, I think they're really powerful psychological tools, sometimes this data, to help us just be more. The first part of changing anything is just being insightful about like what's going on now, like just being present and having some insight. And that's what some of these tools can do.
Yeah. And that really begs the question, how much can you trust the data, right? How accurate is it if you're going to be making changes in your life, responding to it, acting accordingly? What are your thoughts about accuracy? I know one of the listeners sent a question around, for example, the accuracy of the caloric intake measures from the Apple Watch. It's potentially overestimating caloric expenditure. And if people relied on that, they may alter their caloric intake and probably eat more calories than they should have. What are your thoughts about how much can we trust the data for decision making?
So there's two ways to think about this. Again, great questions from your listeners. And also, I know we were talking about this a little bit too before. Two ways to think about this. One is you can look at the individual silos of what they're measuring and say, like, what's the error bars? So for example, and these have been studied at various times. There's been research on validation of various devices or versions. And that's one of the things that makes this tricky, because you do the Apple Watch 6 or something, and then the Apple Watch 8 comes out 2 years later, and they upgrade the sensor and upgrade the algorithms. It's better. So you have to keep doing this. But in general, what's been studied, so like sleep, for example, gets underestimated in terms of this total sleep time. In addition to that, it's the consumer grade wearables are not really great about detecting sleep stages. So it'll say 30 minutes of REM and then deep sleep and so on and so forth. To really get high fidelity data for those kind of stages, you need more sensors, the kind that you would find in a hospital in an inpatient sleep study. So you need an EEG, more actigraphy sensors and video and so on and so forth. That would be helpful. So I think they're a rough guide that are in terms of sleep. In terms of, for example, activity, there is some error in estimating the type of activity you're doing in step counts. So plus or minus, let's say 5 to 10% in the step count. That's getting better and better all the time. I know that I did see a study in the latest Apple Watch today that was pretty accurate. I mean, these step counts are pretty accurate because the waveform is so, we're getting really good at detecting those waveforms. If you do the detection of activity, so if you're exercising on a treadmill and you tell your Apple Watch you're doing treadmill work, that's even better. So as long as your data is accurate, so it can calculate these equations the best it can, like with the right weight, your height, your gender, all those things, it does the best it can. Now, for most average people who are sedentary or who are just struggling to fit that time in, the 30 minutes to get to do your 150 minutes a week, which is basic guidelines, they're good enough. They are good enough to get you off the couch, to help motivate you to work out. There was a study, it was a review out of Australia in 2022 that did show an effect. I was actually surprised by the extent of this effect that wearables across the board, they reviewed a number of studies. It was over 160,000 people in the studies. It was like it on average increased people, it motivated them to move at an average of 40 minutes more per day, which is quite significant, right? If you're wearing a wearable. So that was an overall effect. So the data alone can help motivate you to do it. And I think it's like, I wouldn't worry about the accuracy. If this thing has gotten you to move 40 more minutes, whether it's plus or minus 1,000 steps or not, it doesn't matter. Just go do the movement and it'll be fine. Over the length, over averaging over a year, you're going to see trends that are significant. So in January, when you first did your New Year's resolutions, you were not exercising at all. And in December, now you're hitting 3 times a week, an hour each time with resistance training and cardio. I'm happy. As your physician, I'm like, I'm over the moon for you, right? This is great. You've just cut down your cardiometabolic risk by 35% at least, right? So I think they're good enough. And the accuracy varies in those different silos. Exercise will be a little different. The specific activities are different. The caloric expenditure is interesting. When you look at studies for caloric expenditure, all of these devices tend to overestimate caloric expenditure. They're using slightly very different variations of equations. So it is true that if you want like exactual metabolic cart type data, it's not going to give you that. It's not good enough. It doesn't have enough inputs to understand how your energy balance to that level. In the Apple Watch, I think the Series 7 or 8 was tested, it was the best out of other wearables in terms of how it overestimated it. But nothing overestimated at less than 20%. So there was like at least 20% error. Now, I have seen kind of anecdotal N of one, not peer reviewed, but just people testing this over time to lose weight. And although it's not accurate, it does trend well. There's a level of precision that it's consistently wrong and you can use it to beat a caloric deficit. So whatever it's underestimating, it's like if you want to cut your calories out, the 500 calories, whatever it overestimates, it will overestimate consistently. So you will be in a 500 calorie plus or minus 100 calorie deficit if you decide to do that. So I think you can use it as part of a nutrition plan going forward. I think you just need to trend it over time. But I wouldn't use the absolute numbers to say, so what I would not do is this. It says I'm on a 2,500 calorie plan a day, and I spent 2,800 calories working out today. I guess I can have this croissant that's 250 calories. I wouldn't do that, right? That's really what people want to know. It's like, can I afford this pizza? Like, don't do that. Don't use it for that. It's not going to be that accurate. You're within the variance there. Now, the other way to think about this is, like I said, normal average everyday people who are just trying to meet basic exercise guidelines. These are good enough. I would say they're even good enough for the weekend warriors doing the Spartan races and the obstacle course races and the Tough Mudders and the half marathons. If you are a pro athlete and you're training for the NBA or the Olympics, you're going to want something better, right? There you need a support team with people in a lab, and you don't need a VO2 max estimation. You need to actually measure VO2 max on a treadmill. So if you're at that level, you're probably getting that support, and I wouldn't trust the Whoop Band or the Apple Watch for hard data. For everybody else, I think they're really powerful tools. I wouldn't let that accuracy stop me from making changes in my sleep and making changes in my exercise and my nutrition.
Yeah, that's so helpful, because I think everyone anecdotally has used one of these devices and said, wait a second, it didn't capture X or it overcaptured Y.
Yeah.
How about the kind of balance between intuition and reliance on data, right? Like, as a physician, for example, we order blood tests or imaging tests, and sometimes the patient doesn't feel well, there's nothing on a scan. There's this element of just intuition. And similarly, people may wake up not feeling well, but their device is telling them they slept great, they should be great. Like, there's this tension, right? How much do you listen to yourself and tune into your own body versus how much do you rely on the data you're capturing and say, well, maybe what I'm feeling isn't right? And what is your take on that?
Using wearables and these types of data to understand the entirety of health, like the millions of pathways and hormones and signaling that happens, is like an astronomer using a pair of handheld binoculars to look at the sky. It's a very narrow view. It can be an important view, but it's really narrow. So when we say, really, the question you're asking, as you mentioned, is how do we listen to our bodies? Is our intuition good enough? I would say listening to your body is, I would say, a skill that takes training, and you need to learn the language. Now, one of the things that these wearables can do is help you learn that language, because there are many times we interpret our signals as wrong one way when they're really not that way. I'll give you two scenarios, where one where I would listen and one where I would ignore it and push forward. And this happens a lot. This happened to me. I will have a recovery score and a sleep score in the green, and I will feel like crap. For whatever reason, I woke up that morning and I just feel bad. And I ask myself, these numbers are telling me my body is ready to take on strain today. I don't feel like putting on strain today. Now, in that situation, should I listen to me or should I listen to my Whoop Band? I listen to the Whoop Band. And I'll tell you why. In that case, because this is just a feeling. Like, it's just a feeling that I don't want to train. That feeling is probably something, some part of, like, researcher Lisa Feldman Barrett talks about what emotions really are. And she's, you know, they reflect what she calls the body budget. There's something going on in your body that's not, that's off. Some part, some equilibrium that's just not there yet, right? And still something's buffering. And emotions really are that, right? So when you think you're mad about an issue that with your colleague that you're arguing about, you're really mad because you're hungry or something. And it's like, we misinterpret emotions all the time. So when I'm feeling bad about training, what I do is, and my strain score is good, or my recovery score is good, I think, is this just a feeling that I'm having because I don't want to train? Because I'm overwhelmed with a tough schedule today. I've got to take care of the kids, the house, the stove is broken. I got to call the person to come fix that. And I got to go prepare for this presentation or a podcast. Is that why? And it's usually, yeah, that's usually the answer for me. And so I just go, I'm going to push through. And you know what? I push through that first 5 minutes on the treadmill, and I feel fine. It's amazing. So I just think in that case, I always push through to train. In my world, I have very few reasons not to train every day. Even if I'm injured, it's like that's a good reason. If I'm not injured and my HRV is great, my sleep is great, I'm like, this must be a transitory feeling. There's something off, but I'm going to push anyway. I might not push as hard, but 99% of the time, in like 10 minutes after all that outdoor walk or on the treadmill running, or whatever, I feel just fine. I was like, oh, that was a temporary feeling. And that's one of those things that as humans, we're really bad at interpreting, right? Because that's the cognitive biases we have. It's just, you feel bad, but you feel temporarily bad. And that's where like the people in my experience who stay healthy, you ever have those friends who just stay healthy for like their whole lives? They're really picky about what they eat and they always just seem to be thin. And you're like, what are you doing? Like, what is your secret? And they don't overthink it, right? Their discipline comes first. They don't wait to feel a certain way. They're like, I don't care how I feel. I'm going to go on the treadmill and then I'll feel better. I'll think about how I feel later. That's their attitude. And if you think about 200 years ago, if you were a farmer in the Midwest with no electricity and no Apple Watch or no Whoop Band, it's like, you got to feed the chickens and plow the fields. Like, it doesn't matter what your recovery is, right? They just did it. So there's low risk there when your recovery is good and you're feeling bad, I would say for the most part. Now, there's an exception to that I'll get to in a second. Let's go the opposite way. Let's say your recovery is bad and your device tells you, hey, like put the brakes on today. Don't take on a lot of strain. I listen to that, even however I'm feeling. If I'm feeling really good and I want to push it, I still listen to my Apple Watch or the apps I use in the Apple Watch there. The reason is there's a real downside to getting into a cycle of bad recovery. It's better to just take it easy that day, do something much lower intensity, or just skip it and get some more rest and get those numbers back up to where you're feeling better so that you aren't chasing this cycle of bad recovery that you're just perpetuating. You know, it's like we've all gotten into those cycles before. Poor sleep, you're tired, you're stressed, you're more stressed, you can't sleep. You know, we don't want to do that. So in one case, I listen to my body and the data. In the other case, I ignore it. And most of the time it goes away. There's exceptions to that rule where there are, and this is one of the very, I would say, newer interesting uses of these wearables, which is early detection of acute disease. And this was tested extensively during COVID. So there's data on the Whoop and the Fitbit, I believe. Yeah, Fitbit, the Apple Watch. I can't remember right at this second. But do the heart rate variability metrics and breathing rate change a day or two before you're symptomatic with COVID? There's some several studies that have showed this, right? So that 43% of those people with increased respiratory rate on Whoop ended up getting COVID. So, well, that's really interesting. So the wearable's picking up signals about our body that we haven't picked up consciously or aren't consciously accessible to us yet. And that's an interesting special case. But if the metrics are saying I'm good, most likely I'm just making excuses for myself not to go train. So I just go do it. But I can do it at a lower intensity to make sure. Vast majority of the time, it's just a feeling that I had to push through.
Yeah, so interesting. And what's the best way to utilize these wearables to change behavior? Because there are certainly plenty of people who wear a fitness tracker. They don't get 10,000 steps a day. And yeah, they're like, oh, okay, didn't get there today. Oh, didn't get there tomorrow. Like, it's not always motivating. Like, some people have a sedentary job and they're like, well, I'm not anywhere close. And it really hasn't changed over a year. What's the best way to use these to get to a different place in terms of behavior?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the first thing I would do is just get a baseline. These wearables and the data, wear it for a week. Don't worry about changing a thing. Just do you. Do what you would normally do and see where you end up. You just know where you're starting from. And everyone starts from a different place, and that's completely okay. So if you're only getting 2,000 steps a day and you're tired and you don't have time and you're trying to figure out schedule and you're trying to figure out what you should do in terms of exercise, what would work, that's okay. Just figure out what activity and how many active minutes you have. And that's what wearables are really good at. What is your baseline sleep? What is your baseline activity? What are you eating? Try to track these things in your mindset if you can. The second thing is really to figure out what your kind of goals are. So when it comes to goals, I think about there's numerical goals, like, for example, the 150 minutes a week, which AHA recommends to really reduce, significantly reduce cardiometabolic events, right? Hopefully 300 minutes with those minutes, including vigorous activity as well. But there's also functional goals. So you kind of have to figure out your whys. At Daytona, we use a very personalized method of doing this. And we always start with the where you are. And so where you are tells us one aspect, like your baseline. The second thing is when we say goals, I don't mean like losing weight so that you can feel good at the wedding coming up in 3 weeks, so you can fit in the dress. That's an important goal, but we really try to dig deeper than that. Like, who are you trying to impress at that wedding? Why is it so important to you that these people feel a certain way about you? How do you feel about yourself? We really get to the bottom of what it is that you want, why you want to make these changes. What does health mean to you functionally? And when you start asking questions like that, it starts going away from just heart disease or diabetes to, I want to set a better example for my children. so that they don't end up with diseases. And I want to model good behavior and I want them to think I'm a great mom. Okay, that's really important. And that's the kind of thing that I couldn't get in a doctor's office, didn't have enough time to talk about that with my primary care team or whatever.
The motivational interviewing, right? Like we try and do that in the office. Yeah.
That's right. And so the opportunity to do that presents a lot of great whys. Now we have the why. Now we have your baseline and we do more assessments to figure out the what you should do. So now that we know what that major goal is, we work backwards from that. And we call those goals, we call it captivators in the companies, captivating motivators. It's our weird portmanteau that we made up. But we work backwards from that and we say, okay, what does that mean for this week? What does that mean for this month? And maybe these 3 or 4 months? What is good behavior with exercise that you want to model for your kids? What do you want to see them doing? And then what would you do that would help? And what you could maybe that you could do together? And so we try to make these things connected. And for some people, just the smallest steps make a huge difference. Actually, for most people, you don't have to turn into an athlete overnight. And part of coaching is understanding how to navigate you through this pathway and where to plot where those milestones are. You can do it yourself as well. And some people are really good at doing it. A lot of people find it beneficial to have external help doing this, either with their PCP, their coaching team, health coaches and trainers, and so on and so forth. I think health is a team sport. It just takes a team effort to get this done for people. But the point being, though, it's like when you go to like a gym and you look at the dumbbells, and it's just too overwhelming to think, I'm starting at the 50s. How am I going to get to 120? Like, that's just too overwhelming. You can't do it. But I just know that the 55s are just 5 pounds heavier. And this week, I'm going to see if I can do that. Or I can only walk right now for 3 minutes. I'm 320 pounds. It's painful. It's embarrassing. I don't want to do it. I don't even want to be outside. I just want to walk outside my house or maybe inside my house. Okay, I'll start there. Start there. We can track that with your Apple Watch or your Whoop Band or whatever. And then next week, we're going to go to 10 minutes. And the week after that, we're going to go to 12 minutes or 15 or 20. The thing we do that I think is interesting is when you make a commitment, make sure you hit that commitment because it's important psychologically and from a motivation standpoint to hit these things 80%, that you're not lying to yourself. So if you tell yourself, I'm going to work out every day, I'm going to work out every day, I'm going to work out every day, and you're getting less than 80%, that's less than a B. It's like, don't get less than a B on this, right? It's like, scope the goal down so that you're not letting yourself down. People who stay healthy and can maintain lifestyle changes, they have really high commitment to themselves. And that is a trainable skill. The wearables play a role in helping you build the skill because they're tracking and holding you accountable to the activities. And you can measure that and see them over time. So I say, make small steps, make ones that are realistic that you can hit, and hit them at least 80% of the time. That way, when you look back, you're like, I can do this. Your internal belief system starts to change. Instead of being, I have to go work out, you start thinking, training is something that I do. It's part of who I am. It's what I model to my kids. It's what I model to myself. I don't give that up. It takes a spot in their mind that is something they care about and spend a lot of time on. And that's the real transformation we're seeing with people with coaching and with the use of data and wearables to help guide the coaching. Small steps, building confidence, building resilience. These are powerful things that have long, very big effects on all parts of their lives. It's not just the health. They start seeing benefits in their professional careers, how they relate to other people, family, friends, relationships, stress management, all of it. So this is how we see it working, is that future, right? It's kind of, you have a precision medicine side to kind of figure out the data of what you need to do. What is the dose of medication? What is the dose of exercise? What is the dose of energy balance nutrition? And then it's the precision behavior change. Knowing you, what you care about, your personality, your motivations, your preferences, how can I persuade you to engage in these things day after day in steps that are small enough that you can do them and not let yourself down and build that, what Carol Dweck would call the whole idea of a growth mindset.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Ravi, this is my final question. I'm a big proponent of self-empowerment, completely believe in the need for lifestyle change, democratizing access to information as well as expertise. But how do you see the wearables and digital health integrating with the healthcare system?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I almost feel like chronic disease should be a choice, not an inevitability for people, right? That's like my dream. Like I think all of us had this dream, right? And not just for our patients, but for ourselves, right? So I think there's two aspects to that. One is you can be reactive and proactive. So think about it like a car. Like you want to have the technology in your car such that the car helps you avoid the accident. So in this case, the analogy would be wearables are like the sensors in your Tesla or your Volvo that are detecting cars around you, figuring out where people are going, are going to steer and activate the brakes and things for you. So you just never get into that situation in the first place. But there's another aspect of that, which is, okay, let's just say an accident happened. Well, in that case, you want the technology to make that acute problem go away very quickly. You want the car to call the ambulance for you. You want the car to assess what's wrong and who's involved in your heart rate, all those things, and make that process really well. So there's kind of a proactive component to crashes and a reactive component. In the same way, we have a proactive component to healthcare and we have a reactive component. We are really good at the reactive component of healthcare. Like when you have the heart attack, we get what's the door to balloon time guidelines now? 90 minutes in the continental United States? That's insane. That's like, that is miraculous medicine. I mean, that really is something to be proud of. Cancer treatment, PET scans, all this stuff that we're really good at. If you get into a car accident, orthopedic surgeons can pin you back together and you will walk again most likely and be strong. It's amazing. It really is. The proactive component, however, is where I see wearables really helping. I don't want to detect cancer at stage 3 or 4. I want to detect it at stage 0, right? I want to get the data and wearables and sensors so that can analyze me well enough to predict what's going to happen so I can take actions now to reduce the likelihood of something bad happening in the future. So not only telling me, predicting what's going to happen, but can you help use psychology and behavior science to guide me to take those actions day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. So that's where I see us in that that more proactive component of disease, where lifestyle, as we know, plays a big role. And for some patients, medications on top of that, that's where I really see us integrating into healthcare. I can see us, and I think a lot of this can be done in an automated way. I think it can be done with I would not say simple alerts or reminders, but like persuasive conversational bots and agents that help coaches and doctors deliver these interactions. And as you mentioned before, interoperability is a problem that we're always trying to solve in healthcare. There's tons of data around there. We don't have a data problem. We have an interoperability problem and a behavior problem, right? So it's like getting the right eyeballs on the right information is always challenging, but that's where I see us really helping. It's like you should be coming to a hospital when something really bad happened, like an accident or something not preventable. That's where I see these things integrating. And everyone should have the least amount of technology needed to monitor the least number of things to help keep them well and to trigger that check engine light, if you will, as soon as they detect anything wrong and connect you with the right expertise so you can take action. That's our ideal case, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. 100%. Ravi, thank you so much for all this information. Thank you for the work you do. I think this is such a fascinating area, and I think this is really how we can kind of look at the future of healthcare, which is a lot of chronic disease management. And I think what you're doing, I think digital health, I think marrying that with coaching is really the future of getting people healthier. So thank you. This is really just fascinating.
Thank you for the opportunity to have me on and let me share the vision here. I love talking about this stuff. I love seeing it implemented, and it's challenging, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. I really love hearing feedback, so please leave a review to let me know what you think and rate this podcast. The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness and is copyrighted by Emory University. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.